process started sort of over 5 years ago, really. James and myself were researching various kind of first-person testimonies of blindness, and we came across John's book, a book called Touching the Rock, which was published in the early 1990s and is John's account, really, his diaries, which document that experience of kind of adjustment from going from a position of refusing to accept blindness to one where he almost undergoes a complete kind of transformation and comes to see blindness as a sort of a gift in the end. He discovers a world beyond sight, as he describes it. The foreword to the book mentioned that it was based upon these original cassettes that he'd kept between 1983 and 1986. And so we just reached out to John to see if these cassettes might still be in existence. Got to know him, and about 6 months later, he was generous enough to kind of share this archive with us. And the project kind of went from there.
The voice of Pete Middleton, one of the directors behind the incredibly innovative new documentary Notes on Blindness. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, also ahead today.
We need something right now that's just fun and fizzy, and that's what this is.
Amid much secrecy, the film version of Absolutely Fabulous finally hits screens, but is it any good?
It all seems so absurd, so fantastic. All I can do is get away from here.
Ahead of our show with Nicholas Winding Refn next week, we'll look at his range of specially selected films screening on Mubi, starting with Dario Argento's Suspiria. That's all to come on The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House in London, and I'm joined today by two studio guests, film critic and friend of The Cinema Show, Karen Krizanovich, and, well, he's also a film critic and he's also a friend of The Cinema Show, Jason Solomons. Welcome both. It's hard to believe that the television series Absolutely Fabulous has been on and off the air since way back in 1992. The film version is finally hitting theatres today, amid an awful lot of secrecy, though. Here's a sneak peek.
Hi, darling. No, I'm working for Nobu this week.
You don't know this, and I don't know this, but Kate Moss is changing her PR.
You've got to get her. No.
Kate Moss, darling!
I'm here on the red carpet at London's biggest fashion event of the year.
Oh my, oh my, oh my God.
Stella!
You're not wearing my clothes, are you?
No, this is short.
TK Maxx, TK Maxx!
Jason and Karen, now let's be honest, it would have been so easy for this film to turn out truly awful.
This was extraordinary because they had the premiere in London in Leicester Square. They were very under wraps about the movie. No one could see it beforehand. All the critics had to go to the premiere or just the screening next door in Leicester Square, along with Kylie and Kate Moss and, you know, 1,000 Z-list celebrities. They all had to drink Bollinger champagne. There were 15,000 glasses of champagne drunk in Leicester Square last night during the screening.
That sounds like an average night in Leicester Square, just to be
clear. Exactly. The Wetherspoons was empty. So that's an extraordinary way of making people go and enjoy this film. You will enjoy it. You will enjoy it.
We'll force you to enjoy it by intoxicating you all.
Yes, this is the way to do it. Shower the critical fraternity with that. And I think a lot of critics are waking up the next morning thinking, what did I do?
Was there a film involved?
Oh, look at that review. Well, that's quite a nice review. Then you look at yourself and think, oh my God, did I really sleep with that film? It's, you know, it worked in that space. It's a ropey old TV sitcom transferred to the big screen in the best, worst British tradition. But it really worked. Those two drag it, bitching, screaming, smoking, pill-popping over the line to make what is a riotous night out at the cinema. There's no debating it.
It's a little bit odd when we see translations of TV onto cinema sometimes because you're not used to seeing them look that good. You're not used to seeing the houses and the sets and them walking around in the world in that pristine film sort of quality. I remember when the Australian television series Kath and Kim became a feature film, and there was just something odd about seeing these two bogans suddenly walking around on a cinema screen not looking like they're on television anymore. Karen, did you find it a little bit jarring?
Well, I should have looked into the locations. I really should have, because I'm wondering. It looked very similar anyway. But I think it worked, number one, because I haven't watched the television series for a long, long time. I was never really a big, big fan. I kind of watched it cursorily. But if I watch it, then I start wearing the clothes from it, so I've got to stop myself. But Actually, I think transferred very well, simply because we weren't in the 90s. We were actually, there was a nice juxtaposition of how the 90s is jarring with what we've got today. That, you know, Patsy can't really keep up. She's trying her best. And that actually fit onto the larger screen for me. That really did work. And also the fact that people were allowed to age, people were allowed to change. Yeah, and the new characters I thought worked very well. The pace was wonderful, and the cinematography was actually very good. It wasn't that horrible, I don't want to say this is going to sound terrible, British cinematography that you see on some films. You just think, who lit this?
No, they want to make it look like a sort of Mike Lee film or something. No, yeah, this was shot through, I think, through a whole kind of pot of cold cream. Everything was kind of
glossy,
shiny.
Yeah, it was pacey. It was actually good, big.
Is it still as cutting and biting as it was on television? Because, I mean, it had this very abrasive sense of how ridiculous our worship of celebrity culture is. Does it still come across like that, or do you feel like maybe they're just wheeling out the same old message over and over again?
I think because there's so many pop-up celebrity cameos in here, I think they're going to beat the Zoolander 2 record. Incidentally, I have to say, this is a hell of a lot better than Sex and the City 2, a hell of a lot better than Zoolander 2. That's something to put on the poster. But there are so many celebrity cameos in this film, from, you know, Jerry Hall, who can't act, Kate Moss, who can't act at all, but it's so cool that it doesn't really matter that she can't act. And in fact, that sort of gung-ho, I don't care, I'm so cool, look at my cigarette smoking manner, sort of rubs off on the whole movie. That it gets a bit of attitude. It's sort of, you know what, it's not perfect, but God, we can make this work. So all of those celebrity cameos from people who are on social media and TV presenters on the red carpet, it's very smartly positioned, because all of those people are kind of going, look at me on GMTV, look at me on BBC Breakfast. It's got everything in there about the media world. It's got Orla Gerin presenting the funeral of Kate Moss, you know, as if it was the Middle East summit, you know, and it's brilliantly funny in that respect. So it's about how we're conflating all of this media entity into one. And I think that's what, as Karen was saying, that's very post-1990s. That's very now. And Jennifer Saunders talking, I've been trolleyed on Twitter, which is brilliant. She's totally trolleyed, and she doesn't know what she's doing on Twitter. She's on teeter. That girl is teetering on those gold stilettos all the way through this, managing not to spill a drop of Bollinger from her champagne flute. And it's a metaphor for the movie. It does that. It proceeds that way. But it is so good, that double act, that Laurel and Hardy. One is tall and slim and still, and the other just kind of is big and falling over all the time. And together it works a treat. And they throw themselves with such drunken gusto into these comic roles that you really go with them. In fact, when the celebrity cameos stop and we just concentrate on Patsy and Adina, Jennifer and Joanna, it is actually comic gold.
And I don't think the release of the film is going to be affected so much by this, but maybe, but the fun of it was more because of Brexit. We need something right now that's just fun and fizzy. And that's what this is.
Yeah, and they couldn't have predicted the mood of the nation. But genius does do that, sort of intuits what's going on. And this film arrived at the right time, in the right place, to pop away the blues. And it should do that for this summer.
Woody Allen's opening film from Cannes, Café Society, is hitting theatres across the US very soon. We'll try and nut out which is his best film with Jason and Karen a little later. First, though, John Hull was just 45 years old when he lost his vision. As he struggled with the terrifying feeling of being trapped inside what felt like a small, dark world, he began recording his thoughts on cassettes. Those recordings eventually evolved into a book, then a short film produced for the New York Times, and now a full-length feature documentary. With its use of the actual recorded dialogue synced with actors, and even an accompanying virtual reality experience, Notes on Blindness is a truly remarkable achievement. Directors James Spinney and Pete Middleton popped into Midori House this week to talk me through the film's journey.
John said that for a number of years he felt he was still living in what he called the nostalgia of the visual world. So he was still clinging on to visual memories of his children and of his wife. And it was partly a resolution that he made to reject that nostalgia of the visual world and live wholly in what he called the reality of blindness that led him to kind of reforge his identity as a blind person. I think we're conscious that as sighted filmmakers, there's only, you know, so far that we can go. But that was why it felt so important that we were collaborating with John on the material throughout the process. John's account is one that took place over 3 years, and over that time John kept 16 hours of audio recordings, and he was constantly wrestling with these perceptual shifts in his understanding and his outlook on the world.
I think it's interesting you pick up there on this concept of two separate people. So do you think from your experiences knowing John, is that how he feels now? Is there a John who could see and a John now who can't see? Are they two separate identities now?
John's experience of losing sight was very much a purging process. And it was very much this discovery of a new identity, this coming to terms with living wholly in blindness, he described it as, that really set him up for the remaining 3 decades of his life, really. It was very much a discovery for him, but a painful one and a painful process to undertake. It's interesting because we spent quite a lot of time with John and with Marilyn in the development of the film. And we very much got a sense, of course, that even looking back on this period 30 years previously, they were very different people, that John was a very different person to the person he was back then. And, you know, that we tried to incorporate as much of that into the film as possible. We sort of trying to frame the narration, sort of contemporary narration, as this kind of act of joint remembrance of the two of them searching to sort of understand and to reprocess the events of that period.
Now, you chose in the making of this film to use the original tapes that John had made and sync someone who was, I suppose you could say he's playing the role of John, and to sync those with that person. How important was that in making sure that you felt you were getting to the truth of what's being told?
Well, as soon as we started working with John and Marilyn, working with John's original diary recordings, as well as these family recordings that they kept throughout the period, John would set up audio recorders around the house, much as you would home movies. So there was a tremendous amount of recordings from that time, as well as interviews that we did with John and Marilyn. You know, we knew that we had this incredibly rich first-person story, and that preserving the original voice of that would be integral to the project. So, you know, this wasn't a project that could be an adaptation. On the other hand, approaching that material with some of the conventional tools of documentary, we felt might be kind of distancing to what is such an internal journey. You know, it's a journey that encompasses John's dreaming life, his memories, his kind of imaginative world, as well as these kind of new dimensions in perception that John discovers about how he comes to conceive of space through sound and touch. And so we were looking at creative ways that we might be able to preserve the immediacy and the authenticity of that documentary material, but also be able to follow John on this very internal journey. So we began thinking about the fact that all the voices in the film would remain the voices of John, Marilyn and the children, but on screen they'd be played by actors. And we felt the only way to kind of interface between those two approaches was through this lip-syncing technique, which has been used in other films like Clear Bernard's The Arbor was a kind of key reference for us. And it enabled us to go back to that period. I mean, this is a story that took place 25 years ago. And so there was no real material that we could draw on visually to be able to access it any other way.
Now, I understand that there's a virtual reality aspect to the film as well.
Yeah, well, compliments is very much what we were trying to achieve. I think, as you say, that so we have the feature film, but alongside that, we've also created a virtual reality piece that focuses particularly on some of John's passages from his diaries that address the development of his sensory perception. The experience is kind of broken down into 6 chapters, and each one focuses on a different part of his perceptive or sensory or emotional experience of blindness. There's a chapter where he's talking about how the sound of his children's footsteps in a park that come in and out of existence, bring objects and people in and out of existence, how rain can provide multi-layered depth and detail and contour to the environment around him, how weather transforms space, how thunder can put a roof over his head, and how the sound of wind in the leaves can bring the sounds of the environment to life. So unlike the film, which is kind of a sort of a linear journey in effect over the course of 3 years, sort of documenting John's journey towards acceptance of blindness, the VR experience allows you to explore his experience in a more meditative or experiential manner.
James Spinney and Pete Middleton, directors of Notes on Blindness, which hits theatres today. Still to come on The Cinema Show, I'll put Jason Solomons and Karen Krasanovich in the very difficult position of choosing their favourite Woody Allen film of all time. And we'll preview director Nicholas Winding Refn's special film selection on Mubi, starting with the Dario Argento classic Suspiria. Stay tuned.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Woody Allen's latest treat delighted some and bored others when it opened in Cannes this year. It's set to be unleashed on US audiences in just a couple of weeks. Jason Solomons, your love for Woody Allen's films is well documented in your book, Woody Allen Film by Film. How does Café Society stack up against some of your favourites?
It's interesting, isn't it? You always play that parlour game. It's not whether it works in the week of release. It's like where it sits within the sort of 48 film of Woody Allen. Is it his 23rd best? Or, you know, is it better than Bullets Over Broadway? And where's that one anyway?
This is very, very true.
And that's almost the only criteria you have for it anymore.
That's part of the price of being a legendary filmmaker, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to come up with legendary pieces of cinema over so many, many decades, inevitably, you're going to be compared to yourself. It's better to be compared to yourself than everyone else.
Except you'd like to be compared to Michael Bay, for example. It's better than any Michael Bay movies. If you're comparing yourself to yourself...
That'd be a short show.
I could be the vice president of my country, so be careful.
I mean, they're very different movies. This Café Society, I have to say, is a summer of all Woody's work. You know, there's the classic New York guy goes to L.A. and is fish out of water, which is a bit from Annie Hall. There's the kind of flapper girls dancing in the 1930s, which is a bit of Bullets Over Broadway. There are gangsters. There are kind of glamorous New York nightclubs, which is from Radio Days. It's all there. There's a voiceover from a rather aged Woody Allen himself, reflective, rather kind of pensive. He hasn't done a voiceover for a long time in his work, and it's nice to hear him back. But it's a different guy from the kind of youthful, nostalgic Woody that narrated Radio Days. So all of these are in there. There's even a bit of the crimes and misdemeanors wrestling with the moral implications of your actions that's in there. It could be no one else's work but Woody Allen's, yet it's not the same Woody Allen that made Annie Hall or Manhattan. It's not even the same guy that was kind of wrestling with his new private life in the 90s. It is a very much a now Woody Allen, and I think he's entitled to go back over old ground and give it a little retrospective, if you like, looking back from where he is at 80 years old now.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly.
You're upset, right?
How could you do that? Didn't you know what would happen?
What are you talking
about? Don't! Answer me, prick. You knew. You just didn't give a shit.
Look, why don't you take your coat off for a second and just...
How could you write that book? Huh? Are you so selfish? You're so self-engrossed, you don't give a shit who you destroy.
Yes,
you told our whole story.
I know I can't live like this forever.
Te lo dije o no te lo dije?
Molly. What do you want, Christine?
I want something different.
What?
I don't know. Not this.
There is no answer, Cristina.
Bueno, Antonio, que no lo entiendes, que ya he conseguido lo que quería, quiero otra cosa, que esto ya no le basta, que es como una enfermedad.
Well, you certainly fooled me. I mean, I was shocked, because this is not what I expected.
What did you expect?
I don't know. You said, you had always led me to... you said that he was a great ladies' man.
Yeah,
and
that
he opened you up sexually.
So?
And then this little homunculus.
He's quite devastating.
Which one's Marion?
I am.
Kathy, this is in terrible taste, you know.
Oh, my ex-husband is an authority on taste. Now, what does Emily Post say about adultery with a philosophy professor in a Holiday Inn while his wife is in the hospital having her ovaries removed?
Okay, that's enough. Please leave. I realize that you've been hurt, and if I've done anything wrong, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I accept your condemnation.
I want to go back to school. Get my degree and become, you know, something substantial. I can't just do some mindless job. Ugh, I was forced to take a job selling shoes on Madison Avenue. Oh, so humiliating. friends I'd had at dinner parties, our apartment came in and I waited on them. I mean, do you have any idea what that's like?
We can quite easily pick out some that really stick out to us first. Whether they're our favourites or not, maybe not so sure, but they're the ones that we remember first. For you, what are the Woody Allen films that stick out?
Ooh, well, I mean, of course, I love all the ones that won the Oscars. You know, those are my favourites, really, because I like a winner. But one of the ones that I really loved was Manhattan Murder Mystery. Is actually probably one of my favourites, simply because of the dialogue.
All right, so we need to get to the hard part of today's show, which is choosing out. Perhaps we can just go for our number one favourite. And if you can't choose one, I'll let you choose two. Who wants to go first?
Well, I always say that Annie Hall is my favourite film of all time, of all films, right? So I should say Annie Hall. But because this is a different game, this is within the Woody Allen thing.
The rules have changed.
The rules sort of changed. So I like to say something different to Annie Hall just because it's
okay,
like...
Okay, so what is it?
Okay. It's Radio Days.
Okay.
Wow, a controversial pick.
It's just delicious. It is the way you can put it on. It's like a mixtape of Woody Allen. You can just sort of put that movie on and walk around the house listening to it. And Woody Allen is uncredited. He's the voiceover, and yet he's the biggest star in it. And it has Mia Farrow's divine in it. It's hilarious. It's tender. It's about family. It's about growing up. It's one of the best films about childhood I've ever listened to. The music's terrific. It is, I think, an unpolished gem sitting there. It is my favourite. I love it with a passion.
Karen, you were very reluctant to jump into this game. Come on.
I'm ready now.
We're going to throw you in.
I'm ready. Sleeper.
Sleeper?
Sleeper's my favourite. Absolutely my favourite. The big chicken, the huge strawberry. Woody is a robot, the orgasmatron. You know, her writing the leader's nose, cloning from a nose. How can you not like that?
The checking of the nose. The nose to be checked.
The VW, it starts, and then we discovered that steak and chocolate cake is actually the secret to long life. How could you not love a movie like that?
Oh, pound for pound, it's the one that makes me giggle and laugh the most. You know, she's walking along, he's biting her. You're biting my nails, she says. And he says, yes, that's because you're nervous. You know, there's slapstick in it. It's just, it is brilliant. The design is great. You know who did the
design is amazing.
You know who did the costumes for Sleeper? Joel Schumacher.
Joel Schumacher.
Wow. That explains a lot.
Some gorgeous costumes. She looks
really
great
beautiful.
As Luna.
She is spectacular.
Thing.
It's just, every minute is just
the
great.
Jewish tailors, the robot tailors.
I love
you
them.
You want velvet? We got velvet. So we'll take it in.
I still want an orgasmatron in my house.
I thought your house was an orgasmatron.
You haven't been over for a while. Let's pass the orb. Sorry. It is. It's just hilarious. And also it became... sort of, it was his introduction to really becoming a filmmaker in a way, because, you know, he did everything you always wanted to know about sex, which was, of course, has some wonderful moments as well, especially with Gene Wilder and The Sheep. But Sleeper, and then he went into Love and Death. So I think it's really kind of a gateway film for him.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we're really looking at the pathway for Woody Allen coming out of the late 60s into the early 70s, where he was crossing over from that slapstick sort of world into maybe more cinematic fare. It was only just a few more years before Annie Hall came out in 1977, and then we got to my favourite Woody Allen film of all time, which is Interiors from 1978.
Wow, talk about controversial choice. Brilliant choice, though. Brilliant choice.
The Neon Demon is the new film from director Nicholas Winding Refn. His 2011 crime thriller Drive ignited a sensation with its electro-soaked soundtrack and cool, crisp visuals. We'll hear from the director on next week's program, but to get you into the neon mood, he's programmed a special selection of movies to stream here in the UK for Mubi subscribers. First up on the list is Dario Argento's classic Suspiria. In this week's Critics' Choice, we'll hear the words of Italian film journalist Stefano Notaro, as read by Monocle's Melkon Ciacoglia.
There's perhaps no horror film as utterly overwhelming as Suspiria. Director Dario Argento is a master of the subjective and a monster of cinematic manipulation. The setting here is a dance academy located in one of the most magical corners of Europe, the Black Forest of Freiburg. With interiors soaked in Art Nouveau and hints of German Expressionism, the presence of noir legend Joan Bennett, muse of Fritz Lang, provides a subtle homage to a European craft long gone.
I don't give a damn about being kicked out.
Well then?
It's useless to try and explain it to you. You wouldn't understand. It all seems so absurd. So fantastic. All I can do is get away from you.
In the world of Suspiria, the humans are overwhelmed by elements of magic. Door handles are oddly high, making the cast appear rather smaller than they are. The original script had called for the Academy students to be played by children, but the story was deemed far too gory. Visually, this is by far Italy's most striking film. The primary colours almost seem to burst off the screen. Argento actually used a rare kind of film stock that he found in China, surplus from the material Disney had utilised to create the bright, lush imagery of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
You wanted to kill Elena Marcus! Hell is behind that door! You're going to meet death now! The living dead!
It's no coincidence, of course, that the school is devoted to dance, an art which many believe takes humans as close to the goddesses as they can be. But don't be fooled by that enchanting tone. There's a lingering doom permeating the film that eventually eclipses everything in its path. Like a hallucinatory dream, Suspiria consistently ranks among the most innovative and inspiring horror movies ever produced. And anyone who's ever found a nightmare as terrifying as it was fascinating will understand why.
The words of Italian film journalist Stefano Notaro, as read by Monocle's Melkon Çarçoglian, which indeed does bring us to the end of today's show. Tune in next week as we hear from the director of The Neon Demon himself, Nicholas Winding Refn. Today's show was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at monocle.com, and remember to subscribe to the podcast too. This has been The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Ryland. Bye for now.